So I'm going to begin with a very quick story. I'll try to tell it fast. Kind of a globe-trotty sounding story. In 2009, I was in Japan to give some lectures at a school. And in my unencumbered time, I would travel, do little day trips all by myself, unaccompanied. So I'm in the city of Nara. And there's like people, Japanese people, they're in the street and they're getting really excited about somebody who's making street food. And they're making something that I can only really describe as green powder. They're like getting this green powder. And I couldn't even figure out what they were doing with it. But like people were, they were already kind of queuing up for it. And so I thought, well, I'm an idiot if I don't do this, right? And so I did. And eventually it kind of got turned into a paste. And the paste got turned into like, I don't know. I don't even know how to describe the thing that I ate. And I have no idea what was in it. But it was pretty good. Glad I did it. And I owe it all to Anthony Bourdain in a way. Actually, 4 or 5 days later, I was back here in the U.S. doing an onstage panel with Anthony Bourdain and Alice Waters and Duff Goldman. And Anthony Bourdain was just a consummate pro. You know, he's this kind of guy who just showed up and did exactly what he was supposed to do, didn't give anybody any trouble, hit his marks. You know, maybe not a guy that you would really feel like you were getting to know particularly well. But I do think one of the many contributions of Anthony Bourdain to this world is that people are a little bit more comfortable. I mean, when you go any place, you know, you don't want to eat like a tourist. You'd rather eat a little bit more like the locals. And sometimes you don't even really know which thing is happening. But if you eat street food, you know, food that's like just right out there being served on the street, and if it's a big key point would be street food that the local people seem very interested in eating themselves, you got a pretty good chance that you're going to be knowing that place a little bit better through its food. So we're going to talk about that today. And we're also maybe not so much about the legacy of Anthony Bourdain, but how we deal with these things. I mean, Kate Spade and Anthony Bourdain in the space of a few days, you know, how you process something like this, particularly when people who have so much of what people think they want anyway, don't even want to stay in this world. Joining us now, and let me tell you what else we're going to do. We're going to talk about Kim Kardashian and her new role as clemency counselor and ambassador to Trump for America's downtrodden. We're also going to talk about a podcast that we've been listening to called In the Dark. It is about one of America's apparently totally renewable resources, which is wrongful convictions. There just seem to be unending supplies of them for Nicholas Kristof to write about and people to make podcasts and documentaries about, which is unfortunately, I mean, that's a tragic truth, but it seems to be a real one. Joining us now, it's very exciting, coming back from Vermont after a brief Salinger-like period of retirement or reclusiveness or something, Teresa Kramer, a writer and editor of eContent magazine. I guess, are you no longer associated with The Cut?
We just kind of got old and started ignoring it, so okay. It just doesn't really exist
anymore.
Doesn't
really exist anymore. Yeah. I won't even mention it then. Forget about The Cut. There is no such thing. Don't even ask me what that is. Also joining us, Bill Usman, Director of Media Literacy and Digital Culture Graduate Program at Sacred Heart University, and Tanisha Dugan is a producing associate at TheaterWorks. And something else besides, are you kind of out? Like, can we say this other thing, or are you, is it supposed to be a mystery?
So. What's a mystery?
So, well, we have something called continuity and station ID and stuff like that. And so I don't know.
Yes, you can.
You can just say that?
Yeah,
I don't know. So. I don't know. Maybe, I mean, you know,
Well, you already did.
She signed
well,
an NDA.
I said to you. So anyway, if you hear a voice that sounds like, if you hear a voice on this show today that sounds like a voice you hear a lot on this station, that's because that's Tanisha Dugan who's basically saying, what do you say? You say what station it
is. You can
is,
hear us on 90.5 WNPR and WNPR.org.
There you go. So brush with greatness, you know, what can we say? I don't know exactly where to begin this at all. I just know that this morning a lot of us were very, very surprised. I think we found out a couple of things, including that I think Anthony Bourdain is way more famous slash important to way more people than most people might have guessed. I mean, this is just sort of a bigger story than we might have imagined. But Teresa, there's also just that kind of that sense. If you pair it up with Kate Spade, I mean, these are people kind of at the top of their game early. They have attained many of the things that people think that they should want if people want to be rich and famous. And so it's always kind of an odd little moment to think, well, I guess that isn't – I mean, at some level we know that isn't what makes you happy.
No, it's not. So this morning on my drive down here from Vermont, Mark Maron had reposted his interview with Anthony Bourdain. So I was listening to it and he was I got through the part where he's talking about himself as a child and he was talking about, I was just an angry kid. And you know, his persona was still a fair, I'd say cranky more than angry now, but, you know, and he's sort of a very, he was a little bit of an everyman, right? Because, like, even in this interview, he's like, I was never really that good of a chef. Like, I could work in your kitchen, but I bankrupted a lot of people who I talked into giving me money for to actually open a restaurant. So he was sort of very accessible in a way that not a lot of celebrities are. And but he's also openly struggled with drugs in his past. And the first thing I thought of was, you know, has he relapsed in some way? And and did that lead to this?
Right. Although this was not like a Philip Seymour Hoffman situation. I mean, I guess we now know that he hanged himself in a resort not too far from Strasbourg. So, yeah, Bill, I don't know. I'm just gonna, I should just let everybody's thoughts go wherever they want to go.
Well, one of the things I was struck by, you alluded to this just now, Colin, I opened my Facebook today and everybody is posting about Anthony Bourdain, including people I never would have expected to be posting about Anthony Bourdain. And the outpouring of love for him is cutting across the political spectrum, which doesn't really happen all that often these days. I didn't see anything nasty about him, except for one thing actually was on your page.
On my page, yeah. It was always somebody.
One person, but then other people were going against that person. He wasn't someone who was really on my radar all that much. I never watched his show. It's just not an area that I'm really involved in, just as Kate Spade really wasn't. But I was astounded by how much he is on everybody else's radar and that this has elicited something in people. I don't know if it's because the two of them happened in such close proximity, but it is – I also was stunned in some ways by how much this has become a cultural moment to the case where it was so obvious we had to talk about it today.
Right. No avoiding it. Denisha, where are your thoughts going?
Many places. Anthony and Kate both were sort of a part of my zeitgeist, maybe because of how old I am, right? So Kate Spade bags as a young middle-class person living in Connecticut was a total piece of iconography. If you were, you know, you're of a certain place, you got that bag when you were 13 or 16 or what have you. And Anthony sort of defines that space when I was in college. And he was the great adventurer. And he was, I think for me and my college friends who watched it all together, he took us to parts unknown and gave us the possibility and the accessibility to see places, go to places, try food that had heretofore been told to us or we had absorbed were otherwise scary. And so I'm with everyone who's feeling the feels, and yet I see this as an adventure, right? I think we all don't know what's on the other side of that door. And so the way in which we sort of digest that is with this fear and reckoning and sadness. But for a man who is all about adventure, there's something kind of interesting about that journey. And of course, if this were on TV, I'd say now roll the suicide prevention.
Right. We're actually going to put the suicide prevention lifeline phone number up on the webpage for the show. So I think that might be one of the – because unfortunately, another thing that does happen at times when – if there's kind of a little roll of these things is that other people wind up committing suicide. I don't quite get why that is, but then I kind of do get why that it is. We're tweeting it right now, and it is on the webpage, and I've got it here. I can give it out as well. But if you're listening to this at all and going through anything like that or feeling a pain that you don't know how to get rid of any other way – please don't. I've been through this in my own family. Don't do it. And really, there are other ways and people who want to help. And you can start with that phone call. Well, you can just look on Twitter. We've got it up and lots of other people are tweeting it today. And we'll put it up on the webpage too. But don't. It does literally get better. You know, Teresa, another thing that I was thinking about Bourdain, and I think you touched on it too with his remarks to Marin. I think there's a lot of different kinds of celebrities. But, you know, there's sort of LeBron James, and you know what? We're never going to be LeBron James, and we're never going to be Yo-Yo Ma either, you know? And, I mean, there's all kinds of people that we're never going to be and whose attainments – are just so great and vast, or who have a kind of perfection that we can't come close to. And then there are kind of celebrities who sort of say, yeah, no, I'm really just you plus a few little modifications. And I think Bourdain, although he was, you know, handsome, funny, talented guy, he sort of says, look, I'm you plus I'm a little bit more adventurous. I'm more intrepid. I've got a little bit higher confidence level than you. But, you know, as we looked at him, we thought, I could sort of be more like him anyway, you know? Like, next time I travel, maybe I'll eat something that he would eat.
I mean, he's really just a reality star, right, in a way. But we don't think of him that way because he was doing something sort of admirable with that reality celebrity and exposing people. And he wasn't, you know, the guy who goes and just eats gross things in a different country. He was a guy who's that, Andrew Zimmern or something. But he was the guy who... what was his tagline? Be a traveler, not a tourist, right? Mm-hmm. And which, you know, if you're just going to Orlando and getting on a cruise ship every few years, like, that may not have occurred to you before. And so he was really just a guy. And again, in the Marin interview, he was like, this was so overnight. I wrote a little article in a little alt paper that got picked up by the New York Post. The next day, I had a book deal. And then all of a sudden, I had a TV show. Like, this was so out of the blue for me, which, I mean, that's the American dream, right? That, like, you just, and a lot of Americans would like to think you can just sort of stumble into success that way. And for most people, it doesn't happen, but it did happen for him.
And it's so true. I mean, we can't, you know, being able to be a basketball star is a God-given talent, but being able to travel is a personal risk you can take, mm-hmm. right? And so, like, that is attainable. Like, that is admirable. And the fact that you saw him as a regular guy and not this super wealthy guy with all the means in the world that allowed him to travel in the most lavish ways made it feel like anyone could do it. And I feel like there is a market now for travelers of all kinds. You know, mm-hmm. I see, like, Black World Travelers on the Instagram, and I see travelers for solo, you know, solo yeah. travelers. This idea that you could go on these trips, that you could take these adventures, any man could do that, is incredible.
Well, that's, you know, I was sort of thinking about this because I read the thing you wrote this morning sort of to this end on your Facebook page, Colin, and I was thinking, my friend and I were known for a while for just flying to some random place in America and going on a road trip for a few days. And we ended up in some really weird small towns and met a lot of strange people and really wonderful people, to the point where I'm thinking about retiring to Los Baños, California. And I wouldn't have credited Anthony Bourdain with that before today because, you know, we were going to little tiny towns in America, not French Polynesia. But it's the same thing, really.
So I think we're all talking about, I think, shared humanity, right? Mm-hmm. And that there are those who seem superhuman to us, like LeBron James, although you should all speak for yourselves that you can't be LeBron James. I personally think that I could be LeBron James. But then there's those who their shared humanity really, really comes out. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what people are resonating mm-hmm. with him. And mm-hmm. I want to extend something you said, Teresa. Mm-hmm. This idea of he's not just going around the world eating gross things. He was making this larger point that what's gross to me may not be gross to you. Mm-hmm. That what you find as just your everyday common experience might be very alienating to me, but I can try to get within that experience mm-hmm. and realize that you're not just this weird other. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, even though it was a food show, I do think it was trying to make that point. Let's realize that my way of living in the world doesn't have to be everyone's way of living in the world.
Yes, mister. Yes, yes. Like, and maybe because I'm an idealist at heart. Mm-hmm. And maybe that is why we're seeing such the outpouring, right? Because people want to feel that way and see that way and believe the world to be that way. And he felt like he manifested that.
Well, I mean, I don't know if any of you heard it just driving over here, but they were running an old Fresh Air interview with him. And at one point, Dave Davies or whoever it is says, is it true that you ate an unwashed warthog rectum on one occasion, which is a question you could only ask Anthony Bourdain. I don't know who you will ask that question of now, maybe that other guy you mentioned. But and he said, yeah. And then he said, look, this is a very tribal situation, and it's the part the chief takes. Mm-hmm. It's the best part after they killed it. And he throws it on the grill, and then he serves it medium rare. And he said, and this is a situation where I just had to take one for the team. He said, because this is – he thinks it's the best thing. And if I refuse it in front of him, he loses face, but also – I just won't ever be on the same footing with him. You can't get that relationship back after you said no. And, you know, that's like a – that's sort of to the point that you're all making right now, which is like when you travel, really, a smart thing to say in a lot of situations is what would you have right now? I mean, like if you're dealing with a server or whatever, or, you know, learn chef's choice or something. There's words for that in most languages. Or, you know, I mean, what do you drink when you're, you know, I mean, it's a good question to ask anyway, because otherwise, I mean, we're all kind of scared sometimes. Like, what if they make me have something I'm not used to? But that's why you're traveling. So.
And we are all kind of scared sometimes. And so the other part of this shared humanity is that shared pain. And this is what became obvious to us this morning, that it doesn't matter who you are, we all live in pain. It's really hard to be human.
Yep, absolutely. All right, so we're going to make a transition to a slightly more facile topic, although it wasn't facile for the person receiving clemency. You know, Teresa, you said that Bourdain was sort of a reality star, although I think we can make the distinction between reality stars who are slightly more talented and interesting than we are and reality stars who, shall we say, are not. So Kim Kardashian intervened on behalf of a woman who had been imprisoned for life for a nonviolent drug offense. She intervened with the president of the United States. And let's before we even talk about it, I forget to play the Anthony Bourdain cut, which is too bad. But let's hear her talking to Van Jones on CNN, because we all enjoy hearing Kim Kardashian's voice, of course.
I think just he felt her heart and he explained that to me. And I was just, I mean, when he said he has the papers in front of him and he's signing it, I just, like, my heart was so full.
I'm just going to throw them at you. You tell me who's right and who's wrong. Trump is using you as a political pawn. So now you're sort of, you've endorsed him in a way. You've kind of given him legitimacy. You might be in a campaign video. He used you.
I think Kanye's already given him legitimacy. So I don't, you know, in that way. So I was working on this before. So I don't, like, for being, I don't think I would be used. Mm-hmm. You know, and at the end of the day, he heard me out. We got the job done. So I don't think, like, what could he really use me for?
Such an interesting question, and one we could probably spend hours on, but we are not going to. I think, you know, it's easy to lose sight. This does connect with the next topic we're going to deal with, because this seems to be just this incredible, once again, misprision of justice affecting Alice Johnson, who in 1996 was sentenced to life in prison without parole for a first-time nonviolent drug offense. So she's been behind bars for 21 years. I don't think she cares who gets her out. But it's still, I don't know. I mean, Tanisha, we have to touch on a little bit of that conversation, because it's sort of like, why – I think we know why somebody like that would have access to the president and maybe be able to have a conversation with the president that maybe somebody with a little bit more fully credentialed can't.
Yes, and let's start with the fully credentialed woman who has been working really hard on clemency, Topeka Sam. She has been working really hard to get people who have been wrongfully accused clemency, and so we want to at least speak her name and thank her for her work. In terms of Kim Kardashian and Kanye West, you know, we know what this is. it's the same as, to your point, the Muhammad Ali call out this morning in his quote-unquote press briefing.
We should probably clarify that, which is that the president kind of floated the idea of posthumously pardoning Muhammad Ali, to which Muhammad Ali's lawyer said, you know what? We're good.
He's good. Yeah. He's good. So we're good.
Yeah. There was nothing to pardon him for, because the Supreme Court overturned that conviction in 1971.
And to that point, what this is and the thing that I think is crushing about Kim Kardashian, what is very interesting about the work that Kanye has put out recently, is that I think there is a I know that there is an extreme lack of understanding of blackness and blackhood. And the, you know, when she said the job is done, I think to myself, well, what job? Yeah. Is it the job of getting this one woman off? Because the one woman is actually a representation of a larger problem that I don't think you're capable of having. And clearly, excuse me for saying this, that black man who so quickly left a black woman to have a white woman when he realized his success is incapable of having with you as well. So it's a tough nut to crack. It's a hard pill to swallow because yes, we are happy for this woman to be free and to live her life as well as she can. We are sad because there are no systems to protect this woman as she comes out into freedom after being locked up for as long as she has been. And I don't think Kim is working on that job either.
You know, Bill, this is something you and I both teach about in various ways. And one thing that my class this year kind of decided was, at my urging, is that it really does make sense to look at this moment in American history and American political history in terms of reality television, that many of the rules of reality television have been substituted for the normal rules of political discourse and behavior, and including just that notion that every day something has to happen, right? So in reality television, at minimum, you know, somebody has to throw wine at somebody else. You know, I mean, it's just to have a show, you got to do that. And so, as we've looked at Trump at other times, and it's wow, he can't keep his staff together. He keeps firing people. Well, that's what he did on a show. He had a whole show that was like all about firing people. And so here you have almost once again the perfect distillation of that. That you know, the person that who could reach him would be the person who's really the living embodiment of reality television.
Yeah, of course it was. I don't mind when celebrities or athletes use their power to advance progressive causes. I think that's a really good thing. Along, you know, as Spider-Man or Russo said, with great power comes great responsibility, and we should embrace that. This was thoroughly a reality TV act because it was thoroughly a symbolic act. And I think the problem with symbols is that they can so easily be taken out of context. Let's look at the larger context of what Trump's Justice Department is doing, the way he's rolling back the slight progress that was made in the previous era. And let's look at some of the other people that he has pardoned. Mm. It's great for this woman that she's pardoned. This is a good thing. But what about his pardoning of Sheriff Joe Arpaio, who caused terrible, terrible misery for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people who have been incarcerated and who revels in that. That's part of his identity.
Right. I certainly think that, you know, somebody being put in prison for life based on a nonviolent first drug offense, that's like Jeff Sessions' idea of a really good day. It's like, oh, good, my policies are working.
Right. So we're going to make one exception to that, and that's going to smokescreen and excuse everything else that we're doing to roll back justice.
Which is what reality television is. It's like about one little thing. It's never about like any kind of grand sweeping policy. But I also think, you know, I don't know, did you have something that you wanted to talk about
as opposed to me making you talk about something? You know, I'm trying to think about – so, right, I'm happy to see – someone like Kim Kardashian finally using her celebrity for good, right? Mm. I'm terrified that the president is taking advice from Kim Kardashian. But at the same time, like, she had an opportunity once the paperwork was signed. I understand, like, you can't – you're not going to wait 4 years or 2 years, whatever it is, to get this woman out of jail. You got to work with who's in office. But she had an opportunity in the press afterwards, once the paperwork was signed and she was out of jail, to say the work is not done. This Department of Justice is doing everything it can to fill more beds in for-profit prisons.
Right.
You know.
Right.
And
yeah,
she hasn't. So she, you know, maybe she will at some point, but I'm guessing no. At best, she might find someone else she decides is worthy and start, you know, Instagramming about them.
And to the reality television point, mm-hmm, it's so perfect for the kind of disaster that Kanye West left behind. You know, like if there is anything that she as a wife can do to try to ameliorate some of the loss that Kanye experienced with all of his craziness over the past month, mm-hmm. this is a perfect swipe.
I find that the conversations that I'm in these days astonish me and fascinate me at the same time. So as we head into the break here, I will tell you that it was yesterday in the newsroom. I'm pretty sure that's where this happened. I think the three of us, Betsy Kaplan and Jonathan McNichol and I, were discussing whether or not we would, at the snap of a finger with no conditions attached or no more information than we have right now, exchange Donald Trump as president for Paris Hilton as president. Like if I can, you know, and I was saying yes, absolutely, I will take Paris Hilton. Yes. You know, I don't know. I know very little about her. But I don't think that really militates against her candidacy at all, because based on what I know, I just feel like we would come out of this ahead, you know, that I would take that deal, not with an awful lot of cards face down on the table. I would still take that deal. So but the fact that Betsy Kaplan was the one who was not sure she would take that deal. So I don't know what that says. Anyway,
we have to go talk to Betsy.
The things we, you know, Aristotle, he had things that he talked about hanging around the Lyceum. This is what we talk about now. All right, we're going to come back. We're going to talk about this podcast we've been listening to. Well, now Betsy Kaplan is thinking that I maligned her, but I don't think so, because the whole point of that, really, when you get down to it, it's sort of a Monty Hall question, right? You already know what's behind door number one, Donald Trump as president. You can see that. You don't really know what's behind door number two, Paris Hilton as president. You don't know what really that door is. Would you just take it anyway, thinking it's got to be better? And she was not willing to do that. but I understand there's a risk. I mean, she could be a really, you know, an even worse president somehow. All right. So we have to talk a little bit about something else. It's the second season of a podcast called In the Dark. It is hosted and very much the work of Madeline Barron. Well, we'll just play the trailer just to kind of get you started.
In February of last year, I got an email from a woman in Mississippi. She wrote that there was a man there named Curtis Flowers, who'd been tried 6 times for the same crime. The evidence is iffy at best, she wrote. The man didn't have a chance.
Curtis Giovanni Flowers murdered those 4 people. There's no doubt in my mind. And I think he needs to fry in hell where he's going.
If he was executed, would you go watch?
You damn right I'd go watch. I will stick the needle in it.
I mean, it's hard to trust this investigation. It's hard to trust the people who ran it. And it's hard to trust the prosecution trying this case. Hey, where are the facts? Where is the proof?
Mississippi. You know, we all know what goes on in Mississippi. Once we get you in the courtroom, you ours. If you're black, we got you.
So the last one was full of empty filing cabinets, and this one is full of records.
Just be cautious when you go approaching some white people's houses, talking about Curtis. Just be careful.
All right. So you might be wondering, why did Teresa Kremer drive all the way down from Vermont? Well, there's nobody who's ever been on the news. You know, it's more about A, podcast, and B, true crime podcasts. I mean, by, you know, orders of magnitude, there's nobody who knows as much about them as Teresa Kremer. You really have kind of made a study. Well, like Nicholas Kwa knows more about them than you do. Yeah. But I mean, like around here. So I don't know. Maybe just begin by just saying what jumps out about this particular story, which is being told in Mississippi about a wrongful conviction of a young man who's been in prison now for a very long time for a crime he very well may not have committed. What jumps out at you here?
Well, so there's a few things that jump out that I think made this particular story, because certainly there are thousands, if not millions, of these stories all over the country. This particular story jumps out, one, because he's been tried, is it six times for this same crime, and it just keeps going over and over again. So for most of the time he's been in jail, he actually hasn't been convicted of anything. He's just awaiting his next trial, which seems absurd on its face in so many ways. But then this is Mississippi, right? So we're dealing with a racial legacy that is mortifying, terrifying, and it's
American
and it's but so in the later episodes, we find out that this is not so far from where Emmett Till was killed, and so there is a very on its face public history of racial tensions in a way that is very easy to show in the podcast. That, I mean, literally houses have been burned down, businesses have been burned down. People have been heard saying, you know, if he gets free, you know, another house is going to burn down. The particulars of this story make it very good for this medium, I think.
I think so, too. I on the other hand, I don't know. Tanisha, first of all, I liked this podcast, and I think one thing we can agree about anyway, it's an important podcast. I mean, to the degree that it demonstrates how relatively easy it is to get a completely unwarranted conviction. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying that Curtis Lowers is innocent, but just that nothing about this case so far has really persuasively pointed to his guilt. And often by kind of exploiting the feelings of helplessness or and many of the people who've been sort of persuaded to be witnesses, we discover, did so not because they wanted to be witnesses, but because they actually almost believed they had no choice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know. Yes, they were. this is a interesting podcast to listen to. And I love a podcast. In fact, I would love to continue to be the podcast person because they're so easy to consume.
Ah.
You know, they are.
She's coming for my job.
But it's true.
It's a big tent.
It's a big tent. But it's true. Podcasts are easy to consume, and I think that's a good thing and a bad thing in the case of this particular what I think this podcast is trying to do. Because I did find myself washing over some of the things that were happening because it's, you know, I'm driving in the car, my mm-hmm. mind starts to wander. So it's quintessentially American, and I guess that's part of why it was probably easy for me to wash over some spaces too, because I go, yeah, okay, I know what road we're going down with this. Is it required listening? I guess so, but there's some dramaturgical conversation post listening mm-hmm. that I think is necessary for it to really have the impact that I think the journalists are hoping for.
Right. I want to have that dramaturgical conversation, but I also want to get everybody a chance to sort of do kind of a first reaction thing. So, Bill, just go wherever you want to go.
I want to go to the importance of the podcast because I do think it's deeply important on both the micro and the macro levels. I think that there are different variations of true crime. I don't know if Teresa agrees with me or not, mm-hmm. but I think there is true crime. I said this in some of our emails that kind of functions as lurid spectacle, and this is not that. It's not really about the mystery of who killed the people in the furniture store. That's not really on the table here. But then there's true crime that is about investigative journalism and activist-oriented journalism, really, in terms of this is someone who something unbelievably brutal is happening to, and it's happening because of the cold indifference of our justice system. And I think we have to say it because of racism. And so on the micro level, this is a terrible, terrible tragedy of a real human being who's been in prison for two decades now, living in unbelievably horrible conditions for something that he probably didn't do. And then on the macro level, this is just another story of why Black lives don't matter in the United States. The more visible killings that we see is just one aspect of this. This is more hidden, and it needs to be exposed.
You know, I do want to talk about some of the finer points of it, as Tanisha was saying. But Teresa, as somebody who's listened to a lot of these kinds of podcasts, a couple of things jumped out at me. One of them is this podcast is unusual, not even as a true crime podcast, but also in that other larger realm that includes – you know, Netflix documentaries and things like that. We have this really – we have an inexhaustible load of either wrongful convictions or fishy-looking convictions or law enforcement overstepping the bounds of normal procedure. One thing that's unusual about this, and maybe you could tell me how unusual it is, is I don't think I've ever listened to or watched one of these things where nobody from law enforcement will talk. I mean, one of the things that you just don't get for episode after episode after episode is the prosecutor who, you know, clearly was on the warpath about this, his investigators, or anybody. And this may be a little bit about Mississippi. Like in Connecticut, if there were something like this, we can make these people answer our questions. You know, that's just not an option to not answer our questions. And let me just say the other thing, and then I want you to respond. The other thing that I thought this podcast either unintentionally or intentionally didn't have – as a journalist who used to, you know, do not exactly stories like this, but stories where the fact pattern would be very confusing. I was always looking for a Virgil to guide me through the underworld. Virgil is Dante's guide in the Inferno. And there's nobody in this like that either. There's nobody who can say to these two women, young women reporters, Madeline Barron and her partner Parker, this is how it usually is, or this is not unusual, or this is the way things are in Mississippi, or, oh, no, I've been looking at this kind of stuff for a long time. I've never seen anything like this. There's no – there isn't anybody really except them going to these places and looking at records that nobody's ever looked at or whatever.
Right. So I don't know that I don't think it's that unusual that law enforcement doesn't – talk for these things. When you think back to Serial, which is sort of the granddaddy of all these things, she wasn't able to talk to any prosecutors or law enforcement on tape either. And there was another podcast, and I think it might have been the first season of In the Dark, where she was looking into the Jacob Wetterling case, which was sort of solved in the middle of the podcast. Someone finally confessed, and then, but she was sort of talking about how badly the case had been bungled, and she sort of like just ambushes a prosecutor in a elevator, and they're just like, "I'm not going to talk to you," and walk away. You know, nothing comes of it. And but there is a podcast from the Atlanta Record Journal called Breakdown, and there have been a few seasons of it now, and it's looked at these sort of high profile cases. And I don't actually like that podcast very much. I don't the cases he looks into, I don't find that interesting. But the host is a longtime court reporter. He knows the ins and outs of the Georgia legal system. And he can tell you, like, we don't have this recording because we're not allowed to record in this. And it's legal for them to not release the tapes to us from the trial itself. And he can explain to you sort of why all these things are happening. And you're right, that's sort of missing here, because these are people who moved from, I think, the Midwest to Mississippi for a year to report this story. So they're out of their element. Like, there should almost be a behind the scenes like documentary of them being immersed into small town Mississippi.
Right. Even in Serial, there was that moment where they get that project from, I don't know, University of Virginia or someplace involved. And suddenly there are all these people
the
who actually.
Project.
Was it the Innocence Project?
I think so.
Okay.
Yeah.
I think we're going to get an interview with the prosecutor next week.
Right.
Okay.
Because there's still a couple episodes to come. And I'm pretty. And on the preview, it seemed like she does finally get him to talk on tape.
Right. I want that. I want this guy. Even if, you know, I it's driving me crazy that there's no response on this. One thing, I mean, we can sort of say, well, okay, let's get to the dramaturgy, you know. I mean, you can do this well and you can do this badly. And there are times at which I think one reason your attention might be wandering in the car is because they haven't done as good a job as they possibly could to hold your attention.
It's true. And I think dramaturgy, and I mean that in two ways, right? So we've brought up the one point, which is this idea that Black lives don't matter, which some of us are—I don't know what the right word I'm going to use. Please excuse me if I offend. Some of us are woke enough to admit, and so I think that is one of the themes that this podcast is working on. But I think this idea of judicial command and this idea of state-sponsored terror. Is also one of those themes, and what I am learning is because we're this is a non-shameless plug, but it will make sense in a bit. What I'm learning right now as TheaterWorks is in the middle of Invisible Hand, and as I'm talking to audiences because I moderate those conversations, is that giving that kind of context around Americanness or around issues that are central to America are so important, because right now it's just chatter and noise without the framework. And so you can't talk about you can talk about Curtis, and you can talk about the families that have lost their sons and daughters and husbands and so on and so forth, but it's harder for people to get to that piece, which is Black lives don't matter. Okay, well, that's noise, cuz we've been talking about that for some time. Mm-hmm. But this idea of state-sanctioned terror, this idea that the state can determine when, why, how they want to manipulate you, work with you, I think is a context that needs to be offered to really get anything other than, yes, here's another story of a crime that is going convictionless or criminal, in quotation marks, or not, is he or is he not.
I think in this one, Bill, we're hearing from a lot of very poor people. And you actually, mm-hmm. you don't hear poor people's voices that much. And a lot of these people are really, really, really poor. I always thought that even the beginning of the series of Atlanta, where Earn is really poor, it's like one of the few really poor, like living in storage units and stuff, mm-hmm. really poor characters that you see on television. These are poor people. They don't have any resources. They don't know what their rights are. And they mm-hmm. often do things that we might find ignoble, but I think often it's because they don't know that they have another option or that they won't be made into some kind of horrible victim. We also do meet some other people who've learned to thrive within this system by exploiting its very cynicism, and the pinnacle of this is Odell Hallman. I want to just who's a guy who kind of switches sides back and forth, kind of as needed, as suits him, in a way that you can't possibly find admirable, but you might find it understanding. He's kind of the Omar of this story, although maybe not quite with Omar's code of ethics. But there's another weird thing about this, which you're also hearing rural, poor, Black American voices, which you also don't hear very much, and they often have really interesting ways of expressing themselves. But Bill and I both noticed this kind of odd thing that Madeline Barron does, which is occasionally translate them, even when they're completely understandable. We're just going to play – this is Odell Hallman talking from prison to one of the reporters on this project.
Odell told Samara that DA Doug Evans called him in the jail and started talking to him about the Curtis Flowers case.
Doug Evans found out that I had got caught up on off charge. So he called the jail and asked to speak to me. And he said, Odell, I know you lied on stand. Are you trying to make it right?
Odell said that Evans told him, look, I know you were lying when you testified for the defense, and I'm giving you the chance to make it right. And Odell said he saw an opportunity.
You get caught up in a situation, you know, you can beat it in court, but why go to court spending all kind of money on a lawyer but you got knowledge in your head that the DA won't?
Odell said when he'd gotten caught up in a situation, he could have spent a lot of money on a lawyer, but why do that when you have knowledge in your head that the DA wants?
Bill, this is like a scene from a Woody Allen movie.
Yeah. That's a miscue. Like, that's definitely a miscue. She needs a Jonathan McNichol who would step in and say, why are you doing that? Like, she, you know, like a producer to just say, this isn't necessary. Like, you could clearly understand what he was saying. But so okay, yes. That's a miscue. There are some aesthetic problems with it. There's some pacing problems, as people have pointed out. There are those part of.
Wait,
sort
I have
of
to stop. I did not comment much on the pacing thing in our emails because that is like such a New England perspective, and I just want to say, like, yes, perhaps it sounds really slow to us because we speak quickly. We are. It's cold up here, but yeah. I think it's important to like.
It actually didn't bother me.
Yeah,
I know it did bother some other people, but
that to me is similar to her translating.
But the other thing I want to say about it, though, is that it is about like how we approach this. It's not supposed to be entertainment. And it's not something that we are really supposed to enjoy. There is something different that's happening with this. And, you know, this it gets to your point, Colin, about who is being spoken to. This is like a Howard Zinn type project. This is history being told from the bottom up. And that is what allowed me to look past maybe some of these aesthetic problems in it.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, anyway, we have to stop there, and we're going to have to race through our endorsements on the other side of this break. But no, thanks. Thanks for that. Great conversation in the dark. You should listen to it. I mean, you absolutely should. And you'll get mad, and occasionally you'll get impatient with the actual podcast, but still, listen to it.
Is there anything that Mississippi is really good at? Is that an unfair question? Today's show was produced by Jonathan McPants and me, Kyone Wolf. The release of Amanda Fish from prison was secured by Emeril Lagasse. The part of Bill Curry was played by Sarah Koenig. On Monday, we'll be back on the air taking your calls. And now, back to Colin.
All right, we are going to make some recommendations to you. Tanisha Dugan, you go first.
Sure. I want to invite you all on Sunday to the studio, which is the third floor of 233 Pearl Street, otherwise known as Theater Works, for a conversation on dance, dance dialogue with Rosanna Karabetsos and Anand Bhatt, who is in Invisible Hand. It's a performance conversation hybrid where we're asking the question, is there an ecosystem for dance here in Hartford? Please help us find out. Come.
It's a very good question. All right. Bill Usman, what have you got?
Okay. Two books, but quickly, because I want to say that they should be read together in dialogue with each other. The first is by Nadine Strossen, who is a past president of the ACLU, and it's called Hate, Why We Should Resist It with Free Speech, Not Censorship. But then the other one in tandem is called Must We Defend Nazis? Why the First Amendment Should Not Protect Hate Speech and White Supremacy by Richard Delgado and Jean Stefanchik. I think reading these two together is a really important debate that we need to be having right now.
Interesting. All right. You came all the way down from Vermont. You can recommend as much things as you want.
First, on the true crime tip, I would like to, if you like true crime podcasts and you have a sense of humor and you haven't listened to Dunn Disappeared, you're making a big mistake, especially season two, because the Davistown Goose Ganker is a criminal to be reckoned with. Also, it's past now, but next year, put this on your calendar, the Strolling of the Heifers in Brattleboro, Vermont.
And that's just one day that happens?
It's
daily occurrence.
It's a whole weekend fest. However, it was last weekend. It is Vermont's answer to the Running of the Bulls, wherein children lead cows down Main Street and to the green in a giant parade, and it was maybe the best parade I've ever seen in my life, and I can't recommend it enough, so put it on your calendar for next year.
You left us for that. All right, so I just want to remind people, first of all, to read The Power by Naomi Alderman. We're going to do a Nose on June 29th with Rebecca Castellani, Rand Cooper, and Kate Russian, where we discuss it. But we want to give you time because we like lots of listeners, and we're going to try to set up some kind of parallel way for listeners, either using Twitter or Slack or something, so that there'll be two conversations maybe going on at once or whatever. Okay, so I guess the only thing I'm going to say, I don't want to sound too food-schmoozy about that. Not that that's a bad thing, but you know, just maybe if you want to honor Anthony Bourdain's in some way, like eat something that you don't ordinarily eat, or you know, try something that maybe scares you a little bit, or pick out something. I was in Rome for like about 10 days, and I decided, because I always drink Italian red wine, I'm not going to drink any Italian red. I'm going to drink Italian whites, and I'm not going to drink Pinot Grigio, and I'm not going to drink, you know, because that's like what people think Italian white wine is. And so I just, you know, I don't know. This does sound very food schmoozy. But there's like all these great Italian white wines. And so I came home and I went to the Wise Old Dog, which is where I buy wine. And I said, I'm devoting my summer to drinking Italian white wines. And he said, Jacob, who runs the place, said, well, it's very big-hearted of you. And I said, I know, it's just time to start giving back, right? I just have to do this. But anyway, pick something. It doesn't have to be Italian white wines. Pick something and try it, right? Pick something that opens you up maybe to the, you know, I mean, like, if you live in Hartford and you haven't eaten any Puerto Rican food ever, you know, or you live near Hartford.
Now's the time to start.
Yes, it's going to be a great summer for Puerto Rican food. Take me with you when you do, or try some of the incredible West Indian food around this city. As you go around stuff this summer, too, you're going to see street food that'll be Puerto Rican or West Indian, and it's worth trying out. So, yeah, that would be a good Anthony Bourdain thing. Forget the Italian white wines. Just have some Puerto Rican food and some West Indian food. Danbury, Waterbury, Oliveberry, Woodbury, hitting on New Britain, Vernon, I already said that one, Avon, Farmington, yeah, 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 yeah.